The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome to the special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. Hello, my name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexander Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buss. Chapter 28, The Prison Register. The day after the one on which the scene we have just described took place on the road, between Bellegarde and Beaucaire, a man of between 30 and 32 years of age, dressed in a cornflower blue frock coat, nankeen trousers, and a white waistcoat, whose manner and accent both proclaimed him to be British, presented himself at the house of the mayor of Marseilles. "Monsieur," he said, "I am the head clerk of the House of Thompson, and French of Rome. For the past 10 years, we have had dealings with Morel and Son of Marseilles. We have had some 100,000 francs invested in the business, and we are somewhat uneasy, since the company is said to be on the brink of ruin. I have therefore arrived directly from Rome to ask you for information about its affairs." "I do indeed know, Monsieur," the mayor replied, "that for the past 4 or 5 years, Monsieur Morel seems to have been dogged by misfortune. He lost 4 or 5 ships in succession and suffered from 3 or 4 bankruptcies. But even though I myself am his creditor for around 10,000 francs, it is not appropriate for me to give you any information about his financial affairs. Ask me, as mayor, what I think of Monsieur Morel, and I should tell you that he is a man who is honest to the point of inflexibility, and that he has up to now fulfilled all his responsibilities with the utmost nicety. That is all I can tell you, Monsieur. If you wish to know anything further, you must ask Monsieur de Beauville, Inspector of Prisons, residing at No. 15, Rue de Noailles. I believe he has 200,000 francs invested in Monsieur Morel's firm, and if there is really anything to be feared, as the amount is far greater than mine, you will probably find him better informed than I am about the matter." The Englishman appeared to appreciate the delicacy of this reply. He bowed and left, making his way towards the street in question with that stride which is peculiar to the natives of Great Britain. Monsieur de Beauville was in his study. Seeing him, the Englishman started, as if with surprise, suggesting that this was not the first time they had met. As for Monsieur de Beauville, he was so desperate that it was obvious that his mind, entirely taken up with its immediate concerns, had no room left for either his memory or his imagination to wander back into the past. The Englishman, with the phlegm characteristic of his race, asked him more or less the same question and in the same terms as he had just put to the mayor of Marseilles. "Alas, monsieur," Monsieur de Beauville exclaimed, "your fears are unfortunately quite justified, and you see before you a desperate man. I had 200,000 francs invested in the house of Morel. That money was my daughter's dowry. She was to be married in a fortnight. It was to be reimbursed, the first 100,000 on the 15th of this month, the remainder on the 15th of next month. I advised Monsieur Morel that I wished to have the money paid in due time. And now he has just been here, monsieur, barely half an hour ago, to tell me that if his ship, the Pharaon, does not return between now and the 15th, he will be unable to reimburse me." "But this sounds very like procrastination," said the Englishman. "Why not rather say that it sounds like bankruptcy?" Monsieur de Beauville cried in despair. The Englishman seemed to reflect for a moment, then said, "So you are anxious about the repayment of this debt? More than that, I consider it lost." "Very well, I shall buy it from you."
"You?"
"Yes, indeed. But at a huge discount, I don't doubt."
"No,
for 200,000 francs. Our company," the Englishman said with a laugh, does not do that kind of business. And how will you pay? In cash. The Englishman took a sheaf of banknotes out of his pocket, probably amounting to twice the sum that Monsieur de Beauville was afraid of losing. A look of joy suffused Monsieur de Beauville's face, but he made an effort and said, "I must warn you, monsieur, that in all probability you will not recover 6% of the amount." "That does not concern me," the Englishman replied. "It concerns the House of Thompson and French. I am only acting for them. Perhaps they wish to hasten the ruin of a rival firm. All that I do know, monsieur, is that I am prepared to give you this sum in exchange for the transfer of the debt. All I shall want is a brokerage fee."
"What, monsieur? That is too scrupulous,"
Monsieur de Beauville exclaimed. "There's usually a commission of 1.5%. Do you want 2 or 3? Do you want 5% or more? Tell me." "Monsieur," said the Englishman with a laugh, "I am like my firm, which does not do that kind of business." "No, my fee is quite of a different kind." "Tell me, I am listening." "You are the inspector of prisons?"
"I have been for 14 years.
"You hold the registers of admissions and discharges?"
"Naturally."
"And notes concerning the prisoners are attached to these registers?"
"There's a dossier on each prisoner."
"Well, monsieur, I was brought up in Rome by a poor devil of an abbé who suddenly disappeared. I later learned that he was held in the Chateau d'If. I should like to have some information about his death."
"What was his name?"
"Abbé Faria."
"Oh, yes, I remember very well," Monsieur de Beauville said. "He was mad."
"So it was said."
"Oh, there's no doubt about it."
"Quite probably. What was the nature of his madness?"
"He claimed to have knowledge of some huge treasure and would offer vast sums to the government if it would set him free."
"The poor devil. And he died?"
"Yes, monsieur, some 5 or 6 months ago, last February."
"You have an excellent memory, monsieur, to remember the date so precisely."
"I recall it because something strange happened at the same time as the poor man's death."
"Can you tell me what that was?" the Englishman asked, with a look of curiosity that a close observer would have been surprised to see on his normally impassive features.
"Why, yes, I can. The abbé's cell was some 45 or 50 feet approximately from that of a former Bonapartist agent, one of those who did most to assist in the usurper's return in 1815, a very resolute and dangerous fellow."
"Indeed," said the Englishman.
"Yes," said Monsieur de Beauville. "I even had occasion to see the man in 1816 or 1817. And you could only enter his cell with a squad of soldiers. The man made a deep impression on me. I shall never forget his face."
The Englishman gave a hint of a smile.
"So you say that the two cells," he continued, "were about 50 feet apart. But it seems that this Edmond Dantès, this dangerous man, was called
Edmond Dantès."
"Yes, monsieur. It appears that this Edmond Dantès had obtained some tools, or made them for himself, because they found a passageway through which the two prisoners used to communicate."
"The passage was no doubt made with a view to escape?"
"Precisely. But unfortunately for the prisoners, Abbé Faria had a seizure and died."
"I understand. That must have put an end to the plan for escape."
"But not for the one who was left alive."
"On the contrary, this Dante saw the means to hasten his escape. No doubt he thought that prisoners who die in the Chateau d'If are buried in an ordinary cemetery. He moved the dead man into his own cell, took his place in the shroud into which he had been sewn, and waited for the body to be buried."
"That was a risky plan, arguing some courage," the Englishman said.
"Ah, as I told you, monsieur, he was a very dangerous fellow. But fortunately, he himself relieved the government of any fears it may have had on his account."
"How was that?" What? Don't you understand?
No.
The Chateau d'If has no cemetery. The dead are simply thrown into the sea after a 36-pound cannonball has been tied to their legs.
Which means? Said the Englishman, if he was finding it hard to follow.
Well, of course, they attached the weight to his legs and threw him into the sea.
Really? The Englishman exclaimed.
Yes, monsieur, the inspector went on. You can just imagine the fugitive's amazement when he felt himself falling from the top of the cliff. I should like to have seen his face at that moment.
It would have been difficult.
No matter, said Monsieur de Beauville, in much better humor, now that he was certain of recovering his 200,000 francs.
No matter, I can still imagine it. And he burst out laughing.
So can I, said the Englishman, starting to laugh in his turn, but in the way that the English laugh, through clenched teeth.
I suppose that means, he went on, being the first to regain his composure, that he was drowned.
Yes, well, and truly.
With the result that the prison governor got rid of the maniac and the madman simultaneously?
Just as you say. I imagine some sort of a report was drawn up about it.
Yes, certainly. A death certificate.
You understand, Dante's relatives, if he has any, might wish to know for certain whether he was alive or dead.
And now they can rest assured if they have anything to inherit from him.
He is definitely dead?
Oh, heavens, yes, no doubt about it.
They will have a certificate whenever they want.
So be it, said the Englishman, but to return to the registers.
Indeed, this story distracted us. Forgive me.
For what? For the story?
Oh, not at all. It intrigued me.
It is intriguing.
So, monsieur, you want to see everything concerning your poor abbé. He was as mild as a lamb.
I should very much like to.
Come into my study, and I shall show it to you.
They both went into Monsieur de Beauville's study, where everything was perfectly in order, each register at its number, each dossier in its box.
The inspector asked the Englishman to sit down in the armchair and put in front of him the register and dossier relating to the Chateau d'If, allowing him to peruse it at his leisure, while he sat in a corner and read the newspaper. The Englishman had no difficulty finding the dossier concerning Abbé Faria, but it appeared that he had been greatly interested in the story that Monsieur de Beauville had told him, because after studying these first papers, he continued to peruse the file until he came to the bundle concerning Edmond Dantès. Here he found everything in its place, the denunciation, the interrogation, Monsieur Morel's petition, and Monsieur de Villefort's annotation. He quietly folded the denunciation and put it in his pocket, read the interrogation, and observed that it did not mention the name of Noirtier, and read through the petition dated 10 April 1815, in which Morel, following the advice of the deputy prosecutor, had exaggerated the services rendered by Dantès to the imperial cause with the best of intentions, since Napoleon was then still on the throne, all of which were confirmed by Villefort's signature. At this he understood everything. Under the Second Restoration, this petition to Napoleon, which Villefort had kept, became a deadly weapon in the hands of the royal prosecutor. Thus, he was not surprised, continuing through the register, to find these sentences bracketed together opposite his name. Edmond Dantès, fanatical Bonapartist, played an active part in the return from Elba, to be kept in solitary confinement under the closest supervision. Beneath these lines, in different handwriting, he read, in view of the above note, no action. However, by comparing the writing in the brackets with that on the certificate under Monsieur Morel's petition, he felt certain that both were in the same hand, and that the hand was Villefort's. As for the note appended to the note, the Englishman realized that it must have been placed there by an inspector who had taken a passing interest in Dante's case, but who would have been unable to take any further steps in his favor because of the information that we have just quoted. As we mentioned, the inspector had placed himself some distance away and was reading Le Drapeau Blanc, so as not to inconvenience Abbé Faria's former pupil. This is why he did not see the Englishman fold and pocket the denunciation that Danglars had written in the arbor at La Réserve, which bore the stamp of the Marseille Post Office for the evening collection at 6 o'clock on 27 February. We have to admit, on the other hand, that even if he had seen this, he attached too little importance to the scrap of paper and too much to his 200,000 francs to protest at what the Englishman was doing, however improper it might be. "Thank you," the latter said, slamming the register shut. "I have what I need. Now I must keep my side of the bargain. Prepare a transfer of the money you are owed, in which you acknowledge that you have received the full sum, and I shall count it out." He got up so Monsieur de Beauville could take his place at the desk, where he sat down and proceeded, as quickly and simply as possible, to draw up the necessary paperwork, while the Englishman was counting the banknotes on to the edge of the filing cabinet. Chapter 29, Morrel and Company. Someone who had known the interior of the house of Morrel a few years earlier, and who had then returned to Marseille, at the period now reached by our narrative, would have found it much changed. In place of that relaxed atmosphere of life and good cheer that seems to be, so to speak, exhaled by a firm enjoying prosperity, in place of the happy faces looking out of the windows and the busy clerks hurrying down the corridors with pens behind their ears, in place of the courtyard full of boxes resounding to the shouts and laughter of the delivery men, in place of all this, from the moment he came in, he would have found an indefinable air of sadness and death. The corridor was empty, the courtyard deserted, and of all the many employees who had once crowded into the offices, only two remained. The first was a young man, aged about 23 or 24, named Emmanuel Herbault, who was in love with Monsieur Morel's daughter, and had stayed with the firm despite his relatives' efforts to extricate him, while the other was an old cashier, One Eye, nicknamed Coclès, by the young people who had once populated this vast, busy hive, which was now almost uninhabited, a label that had now so completely and utterly replaced any previous ones that in all probability he would not even have turned around if someone were to have called him by his true name. Coclès had remained in Monsieur Morel's service, and the good man's situation had changed in a rather unusual way. He had simultaneously risen to the rank of cashier and fallen to that of a house servant. He was still the same Coclès, for all that, kind, patient, and devoted, but immovable when it came to arithmetic, the only point on which he would have challenged the whole world, even Monsieur Morel, knowing nothing beyond his Pythagorean tables, but having these at his fingertips, whichever way one chose to turn them, or however one tried to lure him into error. In the midst of the general depression that had settled over the firm of Morel and Son, Coclès was the only one who had remained impassive. There should be no mistake. This impassivity was not due to any lack of feeling, but on the contrary, to an unshakable faith. We have mentioned that the host of clerks and employees who owed their livelihood to the shipowner's firm had gradually deserted the office and the shop, like the rats which, so they say, gradually leave a ship when it has been preordained by fate to perish at sea, with the result that these self-interested guests have entirely abandoned it by the time it set sail. Coclès had watched all of them depart without even thinking to inquire into the cause of their departure. Everything for Coclès came down to a matter of numbers, and in the 20 years that he had worked for Morel's, He had always seen payments go through without hindrance and with such regularity that he could no more accept an end to that regularity or a suspension of those payments than a miller whose wheel is turned by the waters of a plentiful stream would accept that the same stream might cease to flow. Indeed, nothing so far had threatened Cocles' confidence. The previous month's payments had gone through with absolute punctuality. Cocles had noted an error of 70 centimes, which Monsieur Morel had made to his own detriment, and the same day brought the excess 14 sous to Monsieur Morel, who took them with a melancholy smile and dropped them into an almost empty drawer, saying, "Cocles, Cocles, you are a jewel among cash." So Cocles left, more or less satisfied. Praise for Monsieur Morel, himself a jewel among the best men in Marseille, did more for Cocles' self-esteem than a bonus of 50 écus. However, since achieving this victory over the end-of-month payments, Monsieur Morel had suffered some moments of agony. It had meant mustering all his resources. Fearful that the rumor concerning his difficulties might spread through the town if he were seen to be tuning in to such extremities, he had traveled in person to the fair at Beaucaire to sell some jewelry belonging to his wife and daughter, and part of the silver. As a result of this sacrifice, the reputation of the House of Morel had been spared the slightest hint of a stain, but the cash box was totally empty. With its usual egoism, all credit had slipped away, terrified by the rumors. The truth was that, if he was to meet the 100,000 francs which he would owe Monsieur de Beauville on the 15th of the present month, and the second 100,000 francs which would fall due on the 15th of the month following, Monsieur Morel's only hope lay in the return of the Pharaon, which had certainly set sail, as they knew from another ship, which had weighed anchor at the same time and which had come safely to port. But the ship, coming like the Pharaon from Calcutta, had arrived a fortnight earlier, while there was as yet no news of the Pharaon. This is how things stood when, the day after concluding the important business we have described with Monsieur de Beauville, the agent of the firm of Thompson and French of Rome announced himself on his arrival at Morel and Son. He was received by Emmanuel. The young man shied away from any unfamiliar face, because each new one meant a new creditor who had come to demand something from the shipowner, and he wished to spare his employer the unpleasantness of this visit. So he questioned the stranger, but the latter declared that he had nothing to say to Monsieur Emmanuel. He wished to speak to Monsieur Morel in person. With a sigh, Emmanuel called Cocles. Cocles appeared, and the young man asked him to take the stranger to see Monsieur Morel. Cocles went ahead, the stranger following. On the staircase, they passed a beautiful girl of between 16 and 17, who looked uneasily at the stranger. The latter noticed the look, though it was lost on Cocles. Monsieur Morel is in his study. Mademoiselle Julie? He asked. Yes, at least I think he is, the girl replied, hesitating. Cocles, you go first and see, and if my father is there, announce the gentleman. There's no point in announcing me, mademoiselle, the Englishman replied. Monsieur Morel does not know my name. This good man has only to let him know that I am the head clerk of Messieurs Thompson and French of Rome, with whom your father's firm does business. The girl paled and carried on down the stairs, while Cocles and the stranger continued on their way up. She went into the office where Emmanuel was sitting, and Cocles, using a key that had been entrusted to him and which warned the boss of some important arrival, opened a door in a corner of the second floor landing, showed the stranger into an antechamber, opened a second door, which he then closed behind him, and, after momentarily leaving the emissary of Thompson and French on his own, reappeared and signaled to him to enter. The Englishman did so, to find Monsieur Morel sitting at a table, paling at the awful columns of figures in the register that recorded his debts. Seeing the foreigner, he closed the register, rose, and drew up a chair. Then, when the other man was seated, he sat down. 14 years had profoundly changed the merchant, who, 36 years old at the beginning of this story, was now about to reach 50. His hair was gray, his forehead was lined with anxious furrows, and his look, which had once been so firm and confident, had become vague and irresolute, as if it were constantly trying to avoid having to settle on a single idea or a single person. The Englishman looked at him with curiosity and obvious interest. "Monsieur," said Morel, apparently made still more uneasy by this appraisal, "you wish to speak to me?" "Yes, monsieur, you know on whose behalf I am here?" "The firm of Thompson and French, or so my cashier says." "He informed you correctly, monsieur. The firm of Thompson and French had some 300,000 or 400,000 francs to pay in France in the course of this month and the following. So, knowing your reputation for scrupulous punctuality, it collected all the bills that it could find with your signature and requested me to cash these bills successively as they came up for payment and to make use of the funds." Morel gave a deep sigh and drew a hand across a forehead covered in sweat. "So, monsieur," he said, "you have bills of exchange signed by me?" "Yes, monsieur, for some considerable amount." "For how much?" Morel asked in what he hoped was a confident voice. "Well, first of all," the Englishman said, taking a sheaf of papers out of his pocket, "here is a transfer of 200,000 francs made out to the benefit of our firm by Monsieur de Beauville, Inspector of Prisoners. Do you acknowledge owing this amount to Monsieur de Beauville?" "Yes, I do. It was an investment that he made in my company some 5 years ago at 4.5%. To be repaid half on the 15th of this month, half on the 15th of next month." "That's right. Then I have here 32,000 francs for the end of this month. These are bills which you have signed and which have been made out to our order by third parties." "I accept that," said Morel, blushing with shame at the thought that for the first time in his life he might be unable to honor his signature. "Is that all?" "No, monsieur. In addition, I have these bills due at the end of next month, assigned to us by the firms of Pascal and Wild and Turner of Marseille, about 55,000 francs. In all, 287,500 francs. Poor Morel, suffering as all this was being counted out, is impossible to describe. 287,500 francs, he repeated mechanically. "Yes, monsieur," the Englishman replied. Then, after a moment's silence, "I cannot conceal from you, Monsieur Morel, that even allowing for your probity, which until now has been beyond reproach, the general rumor in Marseille is that you will not be able to meet your debts." At this almost brutally direct approach, the color drained horribly from Morel's face. "Monsieur," he said, "so far, and it is now more than 24 years since I took over this firm from my father, who had himself managed it for 35 years, so far, not a single bill signed by Morel and son has been presented at our counter and gone unpaid." "Yes, I know that," said the Englishman, "but as one man of honor to another, tell me honestly, will you be able to pay these as promptly?" Morel shuddered and looked at the man opposite him with more confidence than he had shown so far. "A question which is asked with such frankness," he said, "deserves an equally frank answer. Yes, monsieur, I shall pay if, as I hope, my ship arrives safely to port, because its arrival will restore to me the credit that has been lost to me because of a succession of accidents. But if, by misfortune, the Pharaon, which I am counting on as my last resource, were to fail me, Tears came to the poor ship owner's eyes.
Well, if this last resource were to fail...
Well, monsieur, it's hard to say, but I am already used to misfortune, and I must learn to be used to shame. I believe that I should be obliged to withhold payment.
Have you no friends who could help you in these circumstances?
Morel smiled sadly and said, In business, monsieur, as you very well know, one has no friends, only associates.
That is true, the Englishman muttered. So you have only one hope left?
Only one.
Your last?
My last.
So that if this hope fails,
I am lost, monsieur, completely lost.
As I was on my way to see you, a ship was coming into port.
I know. A young man who has remained loyal to me in my misfortune spends part of his time at a lookout on the top floor of the house, hoping to be able to be the first to bring me good news. He told me of this ship's arrival.
But it is not yours?
No, it is a ship from Bordeaux, the Guérande, also coming from India, but not mine.
Perhaps it encountered the Pharaoh and will bring you news.
I must admit, monsieur, that I am almost as fearful of receiving news of my vessel as of remaining in this uncertainty.
At least uncertainty means the continuation of hope.
And Monsieur Morel added glumly, This delay is not natural. The Pharaoh left Calcutta on February the 5th. It should have been here more than a month ago.
What is that? The foreigner said, straining his ears. What is the meaning of that noise?
My God, oh my God, Morel exclaimed, becoming pale. What is it now?
There was considerable noise on the staircase, comings and goings, even a cry of distress.
Morel got up to open the door, but his strength failed, and he slipped back into his chair.
The two men remained facing one another, Morel shaking uncontrollably, the foreigner studying him with a look of profound pity. The noise had ceased, but Morel still appeared to be waiting for something. The noise had a cause and must in turn produce some effect. The foreigner thought he could hear the footsteps of several people coming up the stairs and stopping on the landing. A key turned in the first door and it creaked on its hinges.
Only two people have the key to that door, Morel muttered, Coclès and Julie.
At that moment, the second door opened and the young girl appeared, pale, her cheeks bathed in tears. Morel got up trembling and leant against the arm of his chair because he could not stand up. He wanted to ask a question, but his voice failed him.
Oh, father, the girl said, clasping her hands, forgive your child who is the bringer of bad news.
The color drained from Morel's cheeks and Julie threw herself into his arms.
Father, father, she cried, have courage.
The Pharaoh is lost? He asked in a strangled voice. The girl did not reply, but nodded her head, still pressing it against his chest.
And the crew? Morel asked.
Safe, said the girl, saved by the ship from Bordeaux that has just come into port. Morel raised both hands heavenwards with a sublime look of resignation and gratitude.
Thank you, Lord, he said. At least you have smitten me alone.
Phlegmatic though the Englishman was, a tear rose to his eye.
Come in, said Morel. I suppose you are all there at the door.
Indeed, no sooner had he spoken these words than Mademoiselle Morel came in, sobbing, followed by Emmanuel. Behind them, in the antechamber, could be seen the rough features of 7 or 8 half-naked sailors. At the sight of these men, the Englishman started. He took a step as if to approach them, then thought better of it and stepped back into the darkest, most distant corner of.
Madame Morel went and sat down in the armchair, taking one of her husband's hands in her own, while Julie remained clinging to his breast. Emmanuel had stayed halfway across the room and seemed to link the Morel family group to the sailors at the door. How did it happen? Morel asked.
Come here, Penelon, said the young man, and tell us.
An old sailor, tanned by the equatorial sun, stepped forward, twisting the remains of a hat between his hands.
Good day, Monsieur Morel, he said, as if he had left Marseille only the day before and had returned from Aix or Toulon.
Good day, my friend, the shipowner said, unable to suppress a smile, even through his tears. But where is your captain?
As far as the captain is concerned, Monsieur Morel, he stayed behind, ill, in Palma. But God willing, it was nothing, and you will see him home in a few days, as fit as you or I.
That's good. Now speak up, Penelon, said Monsieur Morel.
Penelon switched his quid of tobacco from the right cheek to the left, put his hand in front of his mouth, turned around, and spat a long jet of blackish saliva into the antechamber, then stepped forward, and swaying on his hips, began,
Well now, Monsieur Morel, we were near enough between Cape Blanc and Cape Boyador, and sailing before a nice south-southeaster, after having been well and truly becalmed for a week, when Captain Gaumont came over to me, I should mention I was at the wheel, and said, Penelon, old boy, what do you think of them there clouds gathering on the horizon? And I'll be blowed if I wasn't looking at them myself.
What do I think of them, Captain? What I think is they're coming up a bit faster than they need to, and they're a bit darker than well-meaning clouds have any right to be.
I'm thinking the same myself, said the captain, and I'm going to take some precautions. We are carrying too much sail for the wind that's coming. Hey there, bring in the royal and furl the flying jib.
It was not before time. Hardly had the order been carried out than we had the wind on our heels and the ship was listing.
Fair enough, said the captain. We're still carrying too much sail. Furl the mainsail. 5 minutes later, the mainsail was furled, and we had only the foresail, the topsails, and the topgallants.
So tell me, old Penelon, said the captain, why are you shaking your head?
Because, in your place, I still wouldn't be running ahead like that.
I think you're right, old man, he said. There's a puff of wind coming.
If that's how you like to put it, Captain, I said, anyone who bought what's down there at the price of a puff would make on the bargain. It's an out-and-out storm, if I've ever seen one.
By which I mean you could see the wind coming like you can see the dust rising in Montredon.
Luckily, the storm was up against a man who knew it.
Double reef the topsails, the captain yelled. Let go the bow lines and take in the topsails and weigh the yards.
That was not enough in those waters, said the Englishman. I should have reefed him four times and got rid of the foresail.
Everyone started at the unexpected sound of this firm, sonorous voice.
Penelon shaded his eyes with his hand and looked at the person who was so confidently directing his captain's maneuver.
We did better than that, monsieur, the old sailor said, with some respect, because we struck the mizzen and turned into the wind to run before the storm. 10 minutes later, we struck the main topsails and went on with bare masts.
The ship was rather old to risk doing that, the Englishman said.
Yes, it was indeed. That's what did for us.
After 12 hours of being tossed this way and that, as if the devil was on our tail, we sprang a leak.
Penelon, the captain told me, I think we're going under, old chap. Give me the wheel and go down into the hold.
I gave him the wheel and went below. There was already 3 feet of water. I came back up shouting, All hands to the pump, to the pump. But it was already too late. We all set to it, but I think the more we put out, the more there was coming in.
Damn it, I said after we struggled for 4 hours. Since we're sinking, let's sink. You only die once.
Is that how you set an example, Master Penelon, said the captain.
Well, just you wait there. And he went to fetch a pair of pistols from his cabin. The first man who leaves the pump, said he, I'll blow his brains out.
That was well done, said the Englishman.
Nothing inspires a man like the solid argument, the sailor went on.
and all the more so as meanwhile the weather had lightened and the wind had fallen. But for all that, the water kept on rising. Not much, perhaps 2 inches an hour, but it did rise. You see, 2 inches an hour may seem like nothing, but in 12 hours, it's not an inch short of 24. And 24 inches are 2 feet. Those 2 feet added to the 3 we already had already makes 5. And when a ship has 5 feet of water in it, it's fit to be called dropsical. Come on then, said the captain, that's enough. Monsieur Morel will have nothing to reproach us for. We've done what we could do to save the ship. Now we must try to save the men. To the boats, boys, and look sharp about it. Listen, Monsieur Morel, Penelon continued, we love the Pharaon, but much as a sailor may love his ship, he loves his hide better. So we didn't wait to be asked twice, especially as the ship itself was groaning as if to say, be off with you, be off with you. And it was telling the truth, the poor old Pharaon, because you could feel it literally going down under our feet. So in a trice, the boat was in the sea and all 8 of us were in the boat. The captain came down last, or rather, he didn't come down because he didn't want to leave the ship. I had to seize him myself and throw him after our shipmates before jumping in myself. It was not too soon. Just after I jumped, the deck burst with a noise which we would have thought was a volley from a 48-gun man of war. 10 minutes later, it dipped its bows, then its stern, then started to roll over like a dog chasing its own tails. And finally, hey-ho, boys, bruh, down she went, no more Pharaon. As for us, we were 3 days with nothing to eat or drink. And we even started to talk about drawing lots to see which of us would be food for the rest. When we saw the Gironde, we signaled to her. She saw us, made for where we were, put down her boat, and picked us up. That's how it happened, Monsieur Morel. On my word. On the word of a sailor. Isn't that true, you others? A general murmur of assent showed that the storyteller had unanimous support for the truth of the basic facts and the picturesque embroidery of the details. Very well, my friend, said Monsieur Morel. You are fine men, and I already knew that no one was responsible for the misfortune that has befallen me other than my own fate. It's God's will and not the fault of men. Let us bow to his will. Now, how much pay are you owed? Oh, no, let's not talk about that, Monsieur Morel. On the contrary, let's, said the shipowner with a melancholy smile. In that case, we are owed 3 months, said Penelon. Cocles, pay 200 francs to each of these good men. At any other time, my friends, he went on, I should have added, and give each of them 200 francs bonus. But times are bad, and the little money that remains is not mine to give. So accept my regrets and don't hold it against me. Penelon grimaced with emotion, turned to his companions, said a few words to them, and turned back. As far as that's concerned, Monsieur Morel, he said, shifting his quid of tobacco to the other side of his mouth and sending a second jet of saliva into the antechamber to balance the first, as far as that's concerned, what's concerned? The money. Well, Monsieur Morel, my comrades said that for the moment they will have enough with 50 francs each, and they can wait for the rest. My dear friends, exclaimed Monsieur Morel, deeply moved. Thank you. You are all the best of men. But take it. And if you find a good owner to sail with, join him. You are free. This last remark produced a startling effect on the worthy seamen. They looked at one another aghast. Penelon, as if winded by a blow, almost swallowed his quid. Luckily, he put a hand to his throat in time. What, Monsieur Morel? He said in a strangled voice. What? You are dismissing us? Are you displeased with us? No, my children, not at all, said the shipowner. I am not displeased. Quite the opposite. I am not dismissing you. But what do you expect? I have no more ships. I have no further need of seamen. What do you mean you have no more ships? Said Penelon. Well, have some more built. We'll wait. Thank God, we know what it is like to ride out a spell of bad weather.
I have no money left to build ships, Penelon, the shipowner replied, smiling sadly. I can't accept your offer, generous as it is.
Well, if you have no money, don't pay us. We'll just do what the poor old Pharaoh did. We'll keep our sails furled.
Enough, my dear friends, enough, Monsieur Morel exclaimed, stifled with emotion. Go, I beg you, we shall meet again in better times. You go with them, Emmanuel, and see that my wishes are carried out.
At least this is not farewell forever, is it, Monsieur Morel? Said Penelon.
No, my friends, at least I hope not. Goodbye, then.
He signaled to Cocles, who took the lead. The sailors followed the cashier, and Emmanuel followed the sailors.
Now, the shipowner said to his wife and daughter, please leave us alone for a moment. I have to talk to this gentleman.
He nodded towards the representative of Thompson and French, who had remained motionless throughout the scene, standing in his corner and intervening only with the few words we mentioned. The two women looked at the stranger, whom they had entirely forgotten, and left the room. But as she went, the girl addressed a sublime look of supplication to him, to which he replied with a smile that any disinterested observer could have been astonished to see flowering on that icy face. The two men were left alone.
Well, monsieur, said Morel, slumping down into a chair, you saw and heard everything, so there is nothing for me to say.
What I saw, monsieur, said the Englishman, is that you have suffered a further misfortune, as undeserved as the rest, and this has confirmed me in my desire to oblige you.
Oh, monsieur, said Morel.
Let us see, said the foreigner. I am one of your principal creditors, am I not?
You are certainly the one whose bills fall due in the shortest time.
Would you like a stay before paying me?
A space of time might save my honor and so my life.
How long do you need?
Morel hesitated.
2 months, he said.
Good. I shall give you 3.
But do you think that the house of Thompson and French?
Have no fear, monsieur. I take full responsibility. Today is June the 5th.
Yes. We'll reassign all these bills to September the 5th. On that day at 11 in the morning, the clock showed precisely 11 as he spoke, I shall present myself here.
I shall be waiting for you, monsieur, said Morel, and you shall be paid or I shall be dead.
The last words were spoken so softly that the other man could not hear them. The bills were renewed, the old ones torn up, and at least the poor shipowner found himself with 3 months to muster his last resources. The Englishman accepted his thanks with the sang-froid peculiar to his nation and took his leave of Morel, who accompanied him with his blessings as far as the door. On the staircase, he met Julie. The girl was pretending to go down, but in fact had been waiting for him.
Oh, monsieur, she said, clasping her hands.
Mademoiselle, the foreigner said, one day you will receive a letter signed by Sinbad, the sailor. Do precisely as this letter tells you, however strange its instructions may seem.
Yes, monsieur, Julie said.
Do you promise me this?
I promise.
Very well. Farewell, mademoiselle. Stay always as good and virtuous as you are now, and I truly believe God will reward you by giving you Emmanuel as a husband.
Julie gave a little cry, blushed as red as a cherry, and clasped the banister to stop herself falling.
The stranger went on his way with a wave of farewell. In the courtyard, he met Penelon, who was holding a roll of 100 francs in each hand, apparently undecided whether to take them with him.
Come with me, friend, the stranger said. We must
We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Buss.
We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.